hair were followed by Ayla's first menstrual flow, the first time the spirit of her totem battled with another. Ayla understood now that it was unlikely she would ever give birth. Her totem was too strong. She wanted a baby. Ever since Uba was born, she had wanted a baby of her own to love and care for. But she accepted the trials and restrictions imposed by the powerful cave lion. She always enjoyed caring for the infants and children of the growing clan when their mothers were busy, and she felt a pang of remorse when they went to someone else to nurse. But at least now she was a woman, no longer a child who was taller than a woman. Ayla felt an empathetic sense of identity with Ovra, who had miscarried several more times, though earlier in her pregnancies, and not with as much difficulty. Ovra's beaver totem was a little too ferocious, too. She seemed destined to be childless. Ever since the mammoth hunt, and especially after Ayla reached physical adulthood, the two young women often shared each other's company. The quiet woman didn't talk much. She was reticent by nature, the opposite of Ika's open and friendly disposition. But Ayla and Ovra developed an understanding that ripened slowly into a close friendship and extended to include Guv. The fondness between the young acolyte and his mate was apparent to everyone. It made Ovra the object of greater pity, since her mate was so understanding and gentle about her inability to produce a child for him. They knew it made her want a baby even more. Oga was expecting again, much to Braud's delight. She had gotten pregnant soon after weaning 3-year-old Brock. It looked as though she was going to be as prolific as Aga and Ika. Drug was sure Aga's 2-year-old son would be the toolmaker he wanted when he found the boy banging stones together one day. He found a hammerstone to fit Grub's pudgy little hand and allowed him to play nearby when he worked, hitting broken pieces of flint to mimic the napper. Ika's 2-year-old, Aigra, promised to be as outgoing as her mother, a cheerful, chubby, friendly little girl that delighted everyone. Brun's clan was growing. Ayla spent the few days in early spring away from the clan, her required woman's curse, in the small cave of her high retreat. After the far more traumatic death curse, it was almost a holiday. She used the time to work out the kinks and sharpen her throwing skills after the long winter, though she had to remind herself constantly that she no longer had to be secretive about it. Though she had little trouble securing food for herself, she looked forward to her daily visits with Isa at a prearranged place near the cave of the clan. Isa brought her more food than she could hope to eat, but more, she brought company. It was still difficult to spend her nights alone, though the knowledge that the ostracism was limited and of short duration made it easier. They often visited until dark, and Ayla had to use a torch to find her way back. Isa never got over her nervousness about the deerskin Ayla had made for herself while she was dead, so the young woman decided to leave it in the small cave. Ayla learned the things a woman needed to know from her mother, just as all young women did. Isa gave her the straps of soft, absorbent leather that were worn tied to a waist thong, and explained the proper symbols to make when she buried the straps soiled with menstrual flow deep in the ground. She was told the proper position to assume if a man decided to relieve his needs with her, the movements to make, and how to clean herself afterward. Ayla was a woman now. She could be required to fulfill all the functions of a totally adult female member of the clan. They talked of many things of interest to women, though some were familiar to her from her medical training. They discussed childbirth, nursing, and medicine to relieve cramps. Isa explained the positions and motions considered seductive to men of the clan, the ways that a woman might encourage a man to develop a desire to relieve his needs. They talked of the responsibilities of a mated woman. Isa told Ayla all the things her mother had told her, but privately, she wondered if the unattractive girl would ever have need for much of the knowledge. There was one subject Isa never brought up. Most young women, by the time they became women, usually had their eye on a particular young man. Though neither a girl nor her mother had any direct say in the matter, the mother, if she was on good terms with her mate, could tell him of her daughter's wishes. The mate, if he chose, could make them known to the leader, with whom the decision rested. If there were no other considerations, and especially if the young man in question had shown an interest in the girl, the leader might let the young woman's wishes prevail. Not always, certainly not in Issa's case, but the subject of mates never came up between Issa and Ayla, though it was usually one of great interest to a nubile young woman and her mother. There were no young unmated men in the clan, and Issa was sure if there had been, they would not have wanted Ayla any more than any man in the clan wanted her as a second woman. And Ayla herself had no interest in any of them. She hadn't even thought about a mate until Issa brought up the subject of a mated woman's responsibilities. But she thought about it later. On a sunny spring morning, not long after she returned, Ayla went to fill a water bag at the spring-fed pool near the cave. No one else was out yet. She knelt down and bent over, ready to dip the bag in, then suddenly stopped. The morning sun, slanting across the still water, gave it a mirror-like surface. Ayla stared at the strange face, looking at her out of the pool. She had not seen a reflection of herself before. Most water near the cave was in the form of running streams or creeks, and she didn't usually look in the pool until after she had dipped in the container she wanted to fill, disturbing the tranquil surface. The young woman studied her own face. It was somewhat square, with a well-defined jaw, modified by cheeks still rounded with youth, high cheekbones, and a long, smooth neck. Her chin had the hint of a cleft. Her lips were full, and her nose straight and finely chiseled. Clear, blue-gray eyes were outlined with heavy lashes, a shade or two darker than the golden hair that fell in thick, soft waves to well below her shoulders, glimmering with highlights in the sun. Eyebrows, the same shade as her lashes, arched above her eyes on a smooth, straight, high forehead without the slightest hint of protruding brow ridges. Ayla backed stiffly away from the pool and ran into the cave. "Ayla, what's wrong?" Issa motioned. It was obvious something was troubling her daughter.
"Mother, I just looked in the pool. I'm so ugly. Oh, Mother, why am I so ugly?"
was her impassioned response. She burst into tears in the woman's arms. For as long as she could remember, Ayla had never seen anyone except people of the clan. She had no other standard of measure. They had grown accustomed to her, but to herself, she looked different from everyone around her, abnormally different.
"Ayla, Ayla," Issa soothed, holding the sobbing young woman in her arms.
"I didn't know I was so ugly, Mother. I didn't know. What man will ever want me? I'll never have a mate, and I'll never have a baby. I'll never have anyone. Why do I have to be so ugly?"
"I don't know if you're really so ugly, Ayla. You're different."
"I'm ugly. I'm ugly."
Ayla shook her head, refusing to be comforted.
"Look at me. I'm too big. I'm taller than Braud and Goof. I'm almost as tall as Brun, and I'm ugly. I'm big and ugly, and I'll never have a mate."
She gestured with fresh sobs. "Ayla, stop it," Issa commanded, shaking her shoulders. "You can't help the way you look. You were not born to the clan, Ayla. You were born to the others. You look the way they look. You can't change that. You must accept it. It's true you may never have a mate. That can't be helped. You must accept that, too. But it's not certain. It's not hopeless. Soon you will be a medicine woman of my line. Even without a mate, you will not be a woman without status, without value. Next summer is the clan gathering. There will be many clans there. This is not the only clan, you know. You may find a mate in one of the other clans. Maybe not a young man or one with high status, but a mate. Zaug thinks very well of you. You are fortunate that he holds you in such high regard. He has already given Kreb a message to take with him. Zaug has kin in other clan. He told Kreb to tell them of his regard for you. He thinks you will make some man a good mate and wants them to consider you. He even said he would take you if he were younger. Remember that. This is not the only clan. These are not the only men in the world."
"Zaug said that? Even though I'm so ugly?"
Ayla gestured, a look of hope in her eyes. "Yes, Zaug said that. With his recommendation and the status of my line, I'm sure there will be some man who will take you, even if you do look different." Ayla's tremulous smile faded.
"But won't that mean I'll have to go away? Live someplace else? I don't want to leave you and Kreb and Uba."
"Ayla, I am old. Kreb is no young man either, and in a few years Uba will be a woman and mated. What will you do then?" Issa motioned.
Someday, Brunn will pass the leadership on to Braud. I don't think you should live with this clan when Braud becomes leader. I think it might be best if you moved away, and the clan gathering may be your opportunity.
I suppose you're right, Mother. I don't think I want to live here when Braud is leader. But I hate the thought of leaving you, she said with a frown, then brightened. But next summer is a whole year away. I won't have to worry about it until then.
A whole year, Issa thought. My Ayla, my child. Maybe you have to be my age to know how fast a year goes. You don't want to leave me. You don't know how I'll miss you.
If only there were a man in this clan who would take you.
If only Braud were not going to be leader. But the woman gave no hint of her thoughts as Ayla wiped her eyes and went back to get water. This time, she avoided looking in the still pool. Later that afternoon, Ayla stood at the edge of the woods, looking through the brush at the cave. Several people were outside working or talking. She shifted the two rabbits that were slung over her shoulder, looked down at the sling tucked in her waist thong, stuffed it in a fold of her wrap, then took it out and tucked it back at her waist in plain sight. She looked again at the cave, shuffling nervously. Brunn said I could, she thought. They had a ceremony so I could. I'm a hunter. I'm the woman who hunts. Ayla lifted her chin and stepped out from behind the concealing screen of foliage. For a long, frozen moment, everyone outside the cave stopped and stared at the young woman walking toward them with two rabbits slung over her shoulder. As soon as they got over the shock and realized their bad manners, they looked away. Ayla's face burned, but she walked straight ahead with dogged determination, ignoring the surreptitious glances. She was relieved to reach the cave after passing the gauntlet of shocked looks and glad for its cool, dim interior. It was easier to ignore the looks of the people inside. Issa's eyes opened wide, too, when Ayla reached Kreb's hearth, but recovering quickly, she looked away, making no mention of the rabbits. She didn't know what to say. Kreb was sitting on his bearskin, apparently meditating, and didn't seem to notice her. He had seen her come into the cave, and by the time she reached the hearth, he had managed to mask his expression. No one said a thing as she put the animals down beside the fireplace. A moment later, Uba came racing in, and she had no qualms at all about her reactions.
Did you really hunt those yourself, Ayla? She asked.
Yes, Ayla nodded.
They look like nice fat rabbits. Are we going to have them for dinner, Mother?
Well, yes, I guess we are, Issa replied, still embarrassed and unsure.
I'll skin them, Ayla said quickly, taking out her knife.
Issa watched for a moment, then walked over and took the knife from her hand. No, Ayla, you hunted them. I'll skin them. Ayla stepped back while Issa skinned the rabbits, quickly spitted them, and put them over the fire. She was just as uncomfortable as Issa.
That was a good meal, Issa, Kreb said later, still avoiding direct comment about Ayla's hunting.
But Uba felt no such compunction.
Those were good rabbits, Ayla, but next time, why don't you get some ptarmigan, she said.
Uba shared Kreb's predilection for the fat birds with the feathered feet. The next time Ayla brought her kill to the cave, it wasn't such a shock, and before long, her hunting became almost commonplace. With a hunter at his own hearth, Kreb reduced the share he took from the other hunters, except for the large animals hunted only by the men. It was a busy spring for Ayla. Her share of the women's work was not lessened because she hunted, and there were still Issa's herbs to be collected. But Ayla loved it. She was full of energy, happier than she could remember. She was happy she could hunt without secrecy, happy to be back with the clan, and happy she was finally a woman, and glad for the closer relationship she was developing with the other women. Abra and Uka accepted her, though the two older women never could quite forget she was different. Ika had always been friendly, and the attitudes of Aga and her mother had completely reversed since she saved Ona from drowning. Ovra had become a close confidant, and Oga warmed toward her despite Braud. The adolescent ardor Oga had felt for the man had moderated to an indifferent habit, cooled by the years of living with his unpredictable outbursts. But Braud's vindictive hatred of Ayla grew after her acceptance as a hunter. He kept trying to find ways to bedevil her, kept trying to get a reaction out of her. His harassment had become a way of life she had learned to live with. It left her unmoved. She had begun to think he would never be able to disturb her again. Spring was in full flower the day she decided to hunt ptarmigan for Kreb's favorite dish. She thought she would look over the new growths and begin restocking Issa's pharmacopoeia while she was at it. She spent the morning ranging the nearby countryside, then headed for a broad meadow near the steps. She flushed a couple of low-flying fowl, brought down quickly by swifter stones, then searched through the tall grass looking for a nest and hopefully some eggs. Kreb liked the birds stuffed with their own eggs in a nest of edible greens and herbs. She uttered an exclamation of joy when she spied it and carefully wrapped the eggs in soft moss and tucked them into a deep fold of her wrap. She was delighted with herself. Out of sheer joyful exuberance, she sprinted across the meadow in a fast run, coming to a halt, out of breath, at the top of a knoll covered with new green grass. Flopping to the ground, she checked her eggs to make sure they were undamaged and took out a piece of dried meat to lunch on. She watched a bright yellow-breasted meadowlark trill gloriously from an open perch, then take to wing and continue its song in flight. A pair of golden-crowned sparrows, warbling their woeful tune of descending pitch, flitted among the blackberry canes at the border of the open field. Another pair of black-capped, gray-coated birds, named by the chickadee-dee of their call, darted in and out of their nesting hole in a fir tree near a small creek, winding its way through the dense vegetation at the foot of the knoll. Small, vivacious, brown wrens scolded the others as they carried twigs and dried moss to a nest cavity in an ancient, gnarled apple tree, proving its youthful fecundity with its flock of pink blooms. Ayla loved these moments of solitude. Basking in the sun, feeling relaxed and content, she thought about nothing in particular, except the beautiful day and how happy she was. She was completely unaware that anyone else was near until a shadow fell across the ground in front of her. Startled, she looked up into Braud's glowering face. No hunting trips had been planned for that day, and Braud had decided to hunt alone. He hadn't been very diligent. His hunting foray was more an excuse to take a walk on the warm spring day than to provide meat he didn't especially need. He had seen Ayla relaxing on the knoll from a distance and couldn't pass up the opportunity to berate her for laziness, caught in the act of sitting still. Ayla jumped up when she saw him, but that annoyed him. She was taller, and he didn't like looking up at a woman. He motioned her down and prepared to give her a sound scolding. But as she lowered herself, the unresisting, unresponsive look that glazed her eyes irritated him even more. He wished he could think of some way to get a reaction out of her. At the cave, he could at least make her get something for him to see her jump to his command. He looked around, then down at the woman sitting at his feet, waiting with unruffled composure for him to get on with his rebuke and be on his way. She's worse than ever since she became a woman, he thought. The woman who hunts. How could Brunn do it? He noticed her ptarmigan and thought of his own empty hand. Even the look on her ugly face is insolent. She's gloating because she got those birds and I don't have anything. What can I make her do? There's nothing out here I can tell her to get. Wait. She's a woman now, isn't she? There's something I can make her do. Braud gave her a signal, and Ayla's eyes flew open. It was unexpected. Issa told her men only wanted that from women they considered attractive. She knew Braud thought she was ugly. Braud hadn't missed Ayla's shocked surprise. Her reaction encouraged him. He signaled her again, imperiously, to assume the position so he could relieve his needs. The position for sexual intercourse. Ayla knew what was expected. Not only had Issa explained, she had often seen adult members of the clan engage in the activity. All the children had. There were no artificial restraints in the clan. Children learned adult behavior by emulating their parents, and sexual behavior was just one of many activities they mimicked. It always puzzled Ayla. She wondered why it was done. But it didn't disturb her to see a young boy bounce harmlessly on a young girl in conscious imitation of adults. Sometimes it wasn't imitation. Many young girls of the clan were pierced by pubescent boys who lingered in the limbo of not yet men before their first kill. And occasionally a man, beguiled by a young coquette, pleased himself with a not quite ripe female. Most young men, though, felt it beneath their dignity to play games with former playmates. But Ayla had no male playmates near her age except Vorn. And since the earlier days when Aga actively discouraged their association, There had never developed any close contact between them. Ayla was not particularly fond of Vorn, who imitated Braud's actions toward her. Despite the incident on the practice field, the boy still idolized Braud, and Vorn was not about to play mates with Ayla. There was no one else who might have, so she had never even engaged in the imitation of the act. Within a society that indulged in sex as naturally as they breathed, Ayla was still a virgin. The young woman felt awkward. She knew she must comply, but she was flustered, and Braud was enjoying it. He was glad he had thought of it. He had finally broken down her defenses. It excited him to see her so confused and bewildered, and aroused him. He hovered close as she got up, then started to lower herself to her knees. Ayla wasn't accustomed to men of the clan being so near. Braud's heavy breathing frightened her. She hesitated. Braud got impatient, pushed her down, and moved aside his wrap, exposing his organ, thick and throbbing. What is she waiting for? She's so ugly, she should be honored. No other man would have her, he thought angrily, grabbing at her wrap to move it out of the way as his need grew. But as Braud closed in on her, something snapped. She couldn't do it. She just couldn't. Her reason left her. It didn't matter that she was supposed to obey him. She scrambled to her feet and started to run. Braud was too quick for her. He grabbed her, pushed her down, and punched her in the face, cutting her lip with his hard fist. He was beginning to enjoy this. Too many times had he restrained himself when he wanted to beat her, but there was no one to stop him here. And he had justifiable reason. She was disobeying him, actively disobeying him. Ayla was frantic. She tried to get up, and he hit her again. He was getting a reaction from her he never expected, and it stirred him to greater lust. He would cow this insolent woman yet. He hit her again and again, and felt a great satisfaction to see her cringe as he made a move to hit her once more. Her head was ringing. Blood trickled out of her nose and the corner of her mouth. She tried to get up, but he held her down. She struggled against him, pommeled his chest with her fists. They had no effect on his hard, muscular body, but her resistance aroused him to new heights. Never had he felt so stimulated. Violence increased his passion, and lust added force to his blows. He reveled in her resistance and clouted her again. She was nearly unconscious when he threw her over on her face, feverishly ripped her wrap aside, and spread her legs. With one hard thrust, he penetrated deeply. She screamed with pain. It added to his pleasure. He lunged again, drawing forth another painful cry, then again and again. The intensity of his excitement urged him on, rising quickly to unbearable peaks. With a last hard drive that extracted a final agonized scream, he ejected his built-up heat. Braud collapsed on top of her for a moment, his energy spent. Then, still breathing heavily, he withdrew himself. Ayla sobbed incoherently. The salt from her tears stung the open wounds on her blood-smeared face. One eye was swollen nearly shut and turning dark. Her thighs were stained with blood, and she hurt deep inside. Braud got up and looked down at her. He felt good. He had never enjoyed penetrating a woman so much. He picked up his weapons and headed back to the cave. Ayla lay with her face in the dirt long after her sobbing stopped. Finally, she pulled herself up. She touched her mouth, felt the swelling, and looked at the blood on her fingers. Her whole body ached inside and out. She saw blood between her thighs and the stains on the grass. Is my totem fighting again? She wondered. No, I don't think so. It's not time. Braud must have wounded me. I didn't know he could beat me on the inside, too. But the other women don't hurt from it. Why should Braud's organ wound me? Is there something wrong with me? Slowly she got up and walked to the creek, hurting with every step. She washed herself, but it didn't help the throbbing, aching pain or the turmoil in her mind. Why did Braud want me to do that? Issa says men want to relieve their needs with attractive women. I'm ugly. Why should a man want to hurt a woman he likes? But women like it too. Why else would they make the gestures to encourage men? How can they like it? Oga never minds it when Braud does it to her, and he does it every day, more than once sometimes. Suddenly, Ayla was horrified. Oh no, what if Braud makes me do it again? I won't go back. I can't go back. Where can I go? My little cave? No, it's too close, and I can't stay there in winter. I have to go back. I can't live alone. Where else can I go? And I can't leave Issa and Kreb and Uba. What am I going to do? If Braud wants it, I can't refuse him. None of the other women would even try. What's wrong with me? He never wanted that when I was still a girl. Why did I have to become a woman? I was so happy about it. Now I wouldn't care if I was a girl all my life. I'll never have a baby anyway. What good is being a woman if you can't have a baby? Especially if a man can make you do something like that. What good is it anyway? What's it for? The sun was low when she plodded back up the knoll to look for her ptarmigan. The eggs, cushioned so carefully, were crushed and stained the front of her wrap. She looked back at the creek and remembered how happy she was watching the birds. It seemed ages ago, another time, another place. She dragged herself back to the cave, dreading every step. As Issa watched the sun disappear behind the trees in the west, she grew more anxious. She walked partway up all the paths in the nearby woods and to the ridge to scan the slope toward the steps. A woman shouldn't be out alone. I never do like it when Ayla hunts, Issa thought. What if she was attacked by some animal? Maybe she's hurt. Kreb was concerned too, though he tried not to show it. Even Brunn began to worry as it grew dark. Issa was the first to see her walking toward the cave from the ridge. She started to scold her for making her worry, but stopped before her first gesture. Ayla, you're hurt. What happened? Braud beat me, she motioned, her expression dull. But why? I disobeyed him, the young woman gestured as she walked into the cave and straight to the hearth. What could have happened, Issa wondered. Ayla hasn't disobeyed Braud for years. Why would she rebel against him now? And why didn't he tell me he saw her? He knew I was worried. He's been back since noon. Why is Ayla so late? Issa cast a quick glance in the direction of Braud's hearth and saw him staring across the boundary stones at Ayla, against all good manners, with a pleased smirk on his face. Kreb had taken in the whole scene. Ayla's bruised and swollen face and look of utter desolation, Braud watching her from the moment she returned with an arrogant sneer. He knew Braud's hatred had grown over the years. Her placid obedience seemed to affect him worse than her girlish rebellion. But something had happened that gave Braud a sense of power over her. As perceptive as Kreb was, he could not have guessed the cause. Ayla was afraid to leave the hearth the next day, dawdling over her morning meal as long as she could. Braud was waiting for her. Thinking about his intense excitement of the day before had him stimulated and ready. When he gave her the signal, she almost bolted, but forced herself to assume the position. She tried to repress her cries, but the pain forced them from her lips, causing curious glances from those who happened to be nearby. They could no more understand why she was crying out in pain than they could understand Braud's sudden interest in her. Braud reveled in his newfound dominance over Ayla and used her often, though many people wondered why he chose the ugly woman he hated over his comely mate. After a time, it was no longer painful, but Ayla detested it. And it was her hatred that Braud enjoyed. He had put her in her place, gained superiority over her, and finally found a way to make her react to him. It didn't matter that her response was negative. He preferred it. He wanted to see her cower, to see her fear, to see her force herself to submit. Just thinking about it stimulated him. He had always had a strong drive. Now he was more sexually active than ever. Every morning that he wasn't away hunting, he waited for her, usually forced her again in the evening and sometimes at midday as well. He even found himself aroused at night and used his mate to relieve himself. He was young and healthy, at the peak of his sexual prowess, and the more intensely she hated him, the more pleasure he derived. Ayla lost her sparkle. She was dispirited, morose, unresponsive to anything else. The only emotion she felt was an all-consuming hatred of Braud and his daily penetration of her. Like a massive glacier that sucks all moisture from the surrounding land, her loathing and bitter frustration drained away all other feelings. She had always kept herself clean, washing herself and her hair in the stream to keep it free of lice, even bringing in large bowls of snow to set beside the constantly burning fire to melt for fresh water in winter. Now, her hair hung limp in greasy tangles, and she wore the same wrap day in and day out, not bothering to clean the spots or let it air out. She dragged at her chores until men who had never before scolded were rebuking her. She lost interest in Issa's medicines, never talked except to answer direct questions, seldom hunted, and often returned empty-handed when she did. Her despondency cast a pall on everyone else around Kreb's hearth. Issa was beside herself with worry. She couldn't understand the drastic change in Ayla. She knew it was because of Braud's inexplicable interest in her, but why it should have that effect was beyond the woman. She hovered over Ayla, watching her constantly, and when the young woman first began to get sick in the mornings, she was afraid that whatever evil spirit had gotten into her was gaining a greater hold. But Issa was an experienced medicine woman. She was the first to notice when Ayla did not keep herself in the nominal isolation required of women when their totems battled, and watched her adopted daughter even closer. She could hardly believe what she suspected. But by the time another moon had passed and the summer was waxing into full heat, Issa was sure. Early one evening when Kreb was away from the hearth, she beckoned to Ayla.
"I want to talk to you."
"Yes, Issa," Ayla replied, hauling herself up from her fur and slumping down in the dirt near the woman. "When was the last time your totem battled, Ayla?"
"I don't know."
"Ayla, I want you to think about it. Have the spirits fought within you since the blossoms dropped?" The young woman tried to think.
"I'm not sure. Maybe once."
"That's what I thought," Issa said. "You're getting sick in the mornings, aren't you?"
"Yes," she nodded.
Ayla thought her sickness was because every morning that Braud wasn't gone hunting, he was there, waiting for her. And she hated it so much, she was losing her breakfast, and sometimes her evening meal, too. "Have your breasts felt sore?"
"A little."
"And they've grown larger, too, haven't they?"
"I think so. Why are you asking? Why all these questions?"
The woman looked at her seriously. "Ayla, I don't know how it happened. I can hardly believe it, but I'm sure it's true."
"What's true?"
"Your totem has been defeated. You are going to have a baby."
"A baby? Me? I can't have a baby," Ayla protested. "My totem is too strong."
"I know, Ayla. I can't understand it, but you are going to have a baby," Issa repeated. A look of wonder crept into Ayla's unresponsive eyes.
"Can it be true? Can it really be true? Me? Have a baby? Oh, Mother, how wonderful!"
"Ayla, you're not mated. I don't think there's a man in the clan who will take you, even as second woman. You can't have a child without a mate." "It might be unlucky," Issa motioned earnestly. "It would be best to take something to lose it. I think mistletoe would be best. You know, the plant with the small white berries that grows high in the oak. It's very effective and, if properly handled, not too dangerous. I'll make you a tea of the leaves with just a few berries. It will help your totem expel the new life. It will make you a little sick, but..."
"No, no!"
Ayla was shaking her head vigorously.
"Issa, no! I don't want to take mistletoe. I don't want to take anything to lose it. I want a baby, Mother. I've wanted one ever since Ubo was born. Never thought it would be possible."
"But Ayla, what if the baby is unlucky? It might even be deformed."
"It won't be unlucky. I won't let it. I promise I'll take good care of myself so it will be healthy. Didn't you say a strong totem helps to make a healthy baby once it succumbs? And I'll take good care of it after it's born. I won't let anything happen. Issa, I've got to have this baby. Don't you see? My totem may never be defeated again. This may be my only chance."
Issa looked into the pleading eyes of the young woman. It was the first spark of life she had seen since the day Braud beat her while she was out hunting. She knew she should insist that Ayla take the medicine. It wasn't right for an unmated woman to give birth if it could be helped. But Ayla wanted the baby so desperately, she might go into a worse depression if she was made to give it up. And maybe she was right. It might be her only chance. "All right, Ayla," she acquiesced, "if you want it so much. It would be best not to mention it to anyone yet. They'll know soon enough."
"Oh, Issa," she said and gave the woman a hug.
As the miracle of her impossible pregnancy filled her, a smile danced across her face. She jumped up, charged with energy. She couldn't sit still. She just had to do something. "Mother, what are you cooking tonight? Let me help."
"Orak stew," the woman replied, amazed at the sudden transformation in the young woman. "You can cut up the meat if you want." As the two women worked, Issa realized she had almost forgotten what a joy Ayla could be. Their hands flew, talking and working, and Ayla's interest in medicine suddenly returned.
"I didn't know about mistletoe, Mother," Ayla remarked. "I know about ergot and sweet rush, but I didn't know mistletoe could make a woman lose a baby."
"There will always be some things I haven't told you about, Ayla, but you'll know enough. And you know how to test. You will always be able to keep learning. Tansy will work, too, but it can be more dangerous than mistletoe. You use the whole plant, flowers, leaves, roots, and boil it. If you fill the water up to here," Issa pointed to a mark on the side of one of her medicine bowls, "and boil it down to a cup this size," Issa held up a bone cup, "it should be about right. One cup is usually enough. Chrysanthemum flowers sometimes work. It's not as dangerous as mistletoe or tansy, but not always effective either."
"That would be better for women who tend to lose babies easily. It's better to use something milder if it will work. Less dangerous."
"That's right. And Ayla, there's something else you should know about." Issa looked around to make sure Kreb was still gone. "No man must ever learn of this. It is a secret known only to medicine women, and not all of them know it. It's best not even to tell a woman. If her mate asked her, she'd have to tell him. No one will ask a medicine woman. If a man ever found out, he would forbid it. Do you understand?"
"Yes, Mother," Ayla nodded, surprised at Issa's secrecy, and very curious.
"I didn't think you'd ever need to know this for yourself, but you should know it as a medicine woman anyway. Sometimes, if a woman has a very difficult birth, it's best if she never has any more children. A medicine woman can give her the medicine without ever telling her what it is. There are other reasons that a woman might not want a child. Some plants have special magic, Ayla. They make a woman's totem very strong, strong enough to stop a new life from ever starting."
"You know magic to prevent pregnancy, Issa? Can a weak woman's totem become that strong? Any totem? Even if a mogur makes a charm to give strength to a man's totem?"
"Yes, Ayla. That's why a man must never find out. I used it myself after I was mated. I didn't like my mate. I wanted him to give me to another man. I thought if I never had children, he wouldn't want to keep me," Issa confessed.
"But you did have a child. You had Uba."
"Maybe after a long time, the magic loses strength. Maybe my totem didn't want to fight anymore. Maybe he wanted me to have a child. I don't know. Nothing works all the time. There are forces stronger than any magic, but it worked for many years. No one understands spirits completely, not even Mogur. Who would have thought your totem could be defeated, Ayla?" The medicine woman glanced around quickly. "Now, before Kreb comes, you know the little yellow vine with tiny leaves and flowers? Golden thread? Yes, that's the one. Sometimes it's called strangleweed because it kills the plant it grows on. Let it dry, crush about this much in the palm of your hand, boil it in enough water to fill the bone cup until the decoction is the color of ripe hay. Drink 2 swallows every day that the spirit of your totem is not fighting.
Doesn't it also make a good poultice for stings and bites?
Yes, and that gives you a good reason to have it around. But the poultice is used on the skin, outside the body. To give your totem strength, you drink it. There's something else you must take while your totem is fighting. The root of antelope sage, dried or fresh. Boil it and drink the water, 1 bowl every day you are isolated," Issa continued.
"Isn't that the plant with the ragged leaf that's good for Krebs arthritis?"
"That's the one. I know of one other, but I've never used it. It's the magic of another medicine woman. We traded knowledge. There is a certain yam. It doesn't grow around here, but I'll show you how it is different from the ones that do. Cut it into chunks and boil it down and mash it into a thick paste. Then let it dry and pound it into a powder. It takes a lot, 1/2 bowl of the powder mixed with water, to make it a paste again. Every day you are not isolated, when the spirits are not fighting." Kreb entered the cave and saw the two women deeply engrossed in conversation. He could see the difference in Ayla immediately. She was animated, attentive, thoughtful, smiling. She must have snapped out of it, he thought, limping toward his hearth. "Issa," he announced loudly to get their attention. Must a man starve around here? The woman jumped up, looking a little guilty, but Kreb didn't notice. He was so pleased to see Ayla busily working and talking, he didn't see Issa. It'll be ready soon, Kreb, Ayla motioned, and smiling, ran up and gave him a hug. It made Kreb feel better than he had for a long time. As he settled down on his mat, Uba came running into the cave. I'm hungry, the little girl gestured. You're always hungry, Uba, Ayla laughed as she picked up the girl and swung her around. Uba was delighted. It was the first time Ayla felt like playing with her all summer. Later, after they had eaten, Uba crawled into Kreb's lap. Ayla was humming under her breath while she helped Issa clean up. Kreb sighed contentedly. It felt much more like home. Boys are very important, he thought, but I think I like girls better. They don't have to be big and brave all the time, and don't mind cuddling in a lap to go to sleep. I almost wish Ayla were still a little girl. Ayla woke the next morning, wrapped in a warm glow of anticipation. I'm going to have a baby, she thought. She hugged herself, lying in her furs. Suddenly, she was eager to get up. Think I'll go down to the stream this morning. My hair needs a washing. She bounced out of bed, but a wave of nausea overcame her. Maybe I'd better eat something solid to see if it will stay down. I've got to eat if I want my baby to be healthy. It didn't stay down, but after she was up for a while, she ate again and felt better. She was still thinking about the miracle of her pregnancy when she left the cave and started for the stream.
Ayla,
Broud sneered as he swaggered up and made the signal. Ayla was startled. She had forgotten all about Broud. She had more important things to think about, like warm, cuddly nursing babies. Her own warm, cuddly nursing baby. Might as well get it over with, she thought, and patiently assumed the position for Braud to relieve his needs. I hope he hurries. I want to go down to the stream and wash my hair. Braud felt deflated. Something was missing. There was no response in her at all. He missed the excitement of forcing her against her will. Her seething hatred and bitter frustration, which he had never quite succeeded in covering before, were gone. She wasn't fighting him anymore. She acted as though he wasn't even there, as though she didn't feel a thing. She didn't. Her mind was in another realm. She no more noticed his penetration than his rebukes or sharp blows. It was just one more thing she had to accept, and she resigned herself to it. Her calm, self-possessed serenity had returned. Braud's enjoyment was in dominating her, not in the pleasure of the sexual experience. He found he wasn't stimulated anymore. He had trouble maintaining an erection. After a few times of not reaching a climax at all, he backed off and soon stopped altogether. It was too humiliating. She might as well be a stone for all her response, he thought. She's so ugly anyway, I've given her enough of my time. She doesn't even appreciate the honor of the future leader's interest. Oga welcomed him back, relieved that he seemed to be over his unfathomable attraction for Ayla. She hadn't been jealous. It wasn't something to be jealous about. Braud was her mate, and he gave no indication he was ready to give her up. Any man could relieve his needs with any woman he wanted. There was nothing extraordinary about that. She just couldn't understand why he paid so much attention to Ayla when, for some strange reason, she obviously didn't enjoy it. For all his rationalizing, Braud was galled at Ayla's sudden indifference. He thought he had finally found a way to dominate her, to break down her wall of reserve once and for all, and he had discovered the pleasure it gave him. It made him all the more determined to find a way to get to her again. Chapter 19. Ayla's pregnancy astounded the whole clan. It seemed impossible that a woman with as powerful a totem as hers could conceive life. Speculation was rampant about the spirit of which man's totem had succeeded in overpowering the cave lion, and every man in the clan would have liked to claim the credit and the boost to his prestige. Some felt it must have been a combination of several totemic essences, perhaps the entire male population. But most opinions fell into one of two camps, divided almost entirely along the lines of age. Proximity to the woman was the determining factor, which was why most men believed the children of their mates were the result of their own totem spirit.
A woman inevitably spent more time with the man whose hearth she shared. The opportunity for swallowing his totem spirit was greater. Even though a man's totem might call upon the assistance of another man's totem during the ensuing battle, or any spirit that happened to be nearby, the vital force of the first totem had primary claim. A helping spirit might be honored with the privilege of beginning the new life, but it was at the discretion of the totem that asked for help. The two men who had been closest to Ayla since she had become a woman were Mogur and Braud.
"I say it's Mogur," Zaug asserted. "He's the only one with a totem stronger than the cave lion. And whose hearth does she share?"
"Ursus never allows a woman to swallow his essence," Krug countered.
"The cave bear chooses those he will protect as he did Mogur. Do you think a roe deer defeated a cave lion?" "With the cave bear's help. Mogur has two totems. The roe deer wouldn't have to go far for help. No one says the cave bear left his spirit." "I'm only saying he helped," Zaug contended hotly. "Then why didn't she get pregnant last winter? She lived at his hearth then. It was only after Braud developed his attraction for her, though don't ask me what he ever saw in her. It was after he spent so much time near her that the new life started. A woolly rhinoceros is powerful, too. With help, it could have overcome the cave lion," Krug argued.
"I think it was everyone's totem," Dorf put in. "The question is, who wants to mate her? Everyone wants the credit, but who wants the woman?" Brunn asked if any man was willing. "If she's not mated, the child will be unlucky. I'm too old, though I can't say I'm sorry."
"Well, I'd take her if I still had a hearth of my own," Zaug gestured. "She's ugly, but she's hard-working and respectful. She knows how to take care of a man. That's more important than good looks in the long run."
"Not me," Krug shook his head. "I don't want the woman who hunts at my hearth. It's all right for Mogur. He can't hunt anyway, and he doesn't care. But imagine coming back from a hunt empty-handed and eating the meat provided by my mate. Besides, my hearth is full enough with Ika and Borg and the baby Aigra. I'm just glad Dorv can still contribute. And Ika's still young enough to have more. Who can tell?"
"I've thought about it," Druk said, "but my hearth is just too full. Aga and Abba, Vorn and Ona and Grub. What would I do with another woman and child? What about you, Grad?"
"No, not unless Brunn commands it," Grad replied tersely.
The second in command had never quite gotten over a certain uneasiness around the woman who was not born to the clan. She just made him uncomfortable.
"What about Brunn himself?" Krug queried. "He's the one who accepted her into the clan in the first place."
"Sometimes it's wise to consider the first woman before a man takes a second," Goof commented. "You know how Abra feels about the medicine woman's status. Isa's been training Ayla. If she becomes a medicine woman of Isa's line, do you think Abra would like to share a hearth with a younger woman, a second mate, with more status than she?" "I would take Ayla. When I'm Mogur, I won't be hunting as much. I wouldn't care if she brought a rabbit or a hamster to the hearth. They're just small animals anyway."
This is the end of disc number 11. Please insert disc number 12. This is disc number 12.
"I would take Ayla. When I'm Mogur, I won't be hunting as much. I wouldn't care if she brought a rabbit or a hamster to the hearth. They're just small animals anyway. I don't even think Ovra would mind a second woman with more status. They get along well. But Ovra wants a baby of her own. It would be difficult for her to share a hearth with a woman and a new baby, especially when no one's ever expected Ayla to have one. I think it was the spirit of Braud's totem who started it. It's too bad he feels the way he does. He's the one who should take her."
"I'm not so sure it was Braud's," Drug said.
"What about you, Mogur? You could take her for a mate."
The old magician had been quietly watching the men's discussion, as he often did.
"I've considered it. I don't think it was Ursus or the roe deer that started Ayla's baby. I'm not sure if it was Braud's totem either. Her totem has always been an enigma. Who knows what happened? But she needs a mate. It's not only that the baby may be unlucky.
Some man needs to be responsible for it, to provide for it. I'm too old, and if it should be a boy, I couldn't train him to hunt. And she can't do it. She only hunts with a sling. I couldn't mate her anyway. It would be like Drad mating Ovra, especially with Uka still his first mate. To me, she's like the daughter of one's mate, a child of one's hearth, not a woman to be mated. It's been done, Dorv said. The only woman a man cannot mate is his sibling. It's not prohibited, but it's not looked upon with favor either. And most men don't want to. Besides, I've never had a mate. I'm too old to start now. Isa takes care of me. That's good enough. I'm comfortable with her. Men are expected to relieve their needs with their mates once in a while. I haven't had those needs for a long time. I learned to control them long ago. I wouldn't be much of a mate for a young woman. But it may be she won't need one. Isa says she may have a difficult pregnancy. She's already having problems. She may not keep it full term. I know Ayla wants the baby, but it would be better for everyone if she lost it. As reported to the men, Ayla's pregnancy was not going well. The medicine woman feared there was something wrong with the baby. Many miscarriages were of malformed fetuses, and Isa thought it was better to lose them than to give live birth and have to dispose of a deformed baby. Ayla's morning sickness lasted well beyond the first trimester, and even by late fall, when her thickened waist had grown to a bulge, she had trouble keeping food down. When she started spotting and passing clots, Isa asked Brun's permission for Ayla to be excused from normal activities, and she confined the young woman to her bed. Isa's fears about Ayla's baby grew with the difficulties of her pregnancy. She felt strongly that Ayla should let the baby go. She was sure it wouldn't take much to dislodge it, for all that her stomach attested to the baby's growth. She feared more for Ayla. The baby was taking too much out of her. Her arms and legs grew thinner in contrast to her expanding middle. She had no appetite and forced herself to eat the special foods Isa prepared for her. Dark circles formed around her eyes, and her thick, lustrous hair became limp. She was always cold, just didn't have the physical reserves to keep warm, and spent most of the time huddled close to the fire, bundled in furs. But when Isa suggested that Ayla should take the medicine that would end the pregnancy, the young woman refused. "Isa, I want my baby. Help me," Ayla pleaded. "You can help me. I know you can. I'll do whatever you say. Just help me to have my baby." Isa could not refuse. For some time she had depended on Ayla to bring her the plant she needed, seldom going out herself. Strenuous exercise brought on coughing spasms. Isa had been keeping herself heavily dosed with medicines to hide the consumptive lung disease that grew worse each winter. But for Ayla, she would go out to look for a certain route that helped prevent miscarriage. The medicine woman left the cave early one morning to search the upland forests and damp barrens for the special route. The sun was shining in a clear sky when she started out. Isa thought it was going to be one of those warm days in late fall and didn't want to burden herself with extra clothes. Besides, she planned to be back before the sun was high. She followed a path into the forest near the cave, then turned off along a creek and began climbing the steep slopes. She was weaker than she thought. Her breath was short, and she had to rest often or wait for a racking spasm of coughing to pass. By mid-morning, the weather turned. Clouds blew in from the east on a chill wind, and when they reached the foothills, dropped their heavy load of moisture in a driving sleet. In the first few moments, Isa was soaked. The rain had slackened by the time she found the kind of pine forest and plant she was looking for. Shivering in the cold drizzle, she dug the roots out of the muddy ground. Her cough was worse on the way back, convulsing her body every few moments and bringing bloody foam to her lips. She wasn't as familiar with the terrain around this cave as she had been with the environment of the clan's previous home. She became disoriented, following the wrong creek down the slope, and had to backtrack before she found the right one. It was nearing dark when the thoroughly wet and chilled medicine woman found her way back to the cave. "Mother, where have you been?" Ayla gestured. "You're soaked and shivering. Come to the fire. Let me get you some dry clothes. I found some rattlesnake root for you, Ayla. Wash it and chew." Isa had to stop as another spasm overwhelmed her.
Her eyes were feverish, her face flushed.
Chew it raw. It will help you keep the baby.
You didn't go out in that rain just to find a route for me, did you? Don't you know I'd rather lose the baby than lose you? You're too sick to go out like that. You know you are.
Ayla knew Issa had not been well for years. But until then, she didn't know just how sick the woman really was.
The young woman forgot her pregnancy, ignored it when she bled occasionally, forgot to eat half the time, and refused to leave Issa's side. When she slept, it was on a fur beside the woman's bed. Uba, too, kept a constant watch. It was the young girl's first experience with grave illness in one she loved, and the effect was traumatic. She watched everything Ayla did, helped her, and it opened up an understanding of her own heritage and destiny. Uba wasn't the only one who watched Ayla. The whole clan was concerned for the medicine woman and not entirely certain of the young woman's skill. She was oblivious to their apprehension. Her complete attention was focused on the woman she called mother. Ayla searched her brain for every remedy Issa had ever taught her. She questioned Uba for the information she knew was stored in the child's memory and applied a certain logic of her own. The special talent Issa had noticed, an ability to discover and treat the real problem, was Ayla's forte. She was a diagnostician. From small clues, she could put together a picture like pieces of a puzzle and fill in the blanks with reasoning and intuition. It was an ability for which her brain alone, among all those who shared the cave, was uniquely suited. The crisis of Issa's illness was the stimulus that sharpened her talent. Ayla applied the remedies she had learned from the medicine woman, then tried new techniques that suggested themselves from other uses, sometimes far removed. Whatever it was, the medication or the loving care or the medicine woman's own will to live, most likely it was all of them, by the time winter had piled high drifts against the wind barriers at the entrance, Issa was sufficiently recovered to take charge of Ayla's pregnancy again. It was none too soon. The strain of nursing Issa back to health had its effect. Ayla spotted blood continuously the rest of the winter and lived with a constant backache. She woke in the middle of the night with cramps in her legs and still vomited frequently. Issa expected her to lose the baby any time. She didn't know how Ayla hung on to it, and she didn't know how the baby could continue to develop with Ayla so weak. But develop it did. The young woman's stomach swelled to unbelievable proportions, and the baby kicked so vigorously and continuously she could hardly sleep. Issa had never seen a woman suffer through a more difficult pregnancy. Ayla never complained. She was afraid Issa would think she was ready to give the baby up, though she was much too far along for the medicine woman to consider it. Nor did Ayla consider it. Her suffering only made her more convinced that if she lost this one, she would never have another baby. From her bed, Ayla watched the spring rains wash away the snow, and the first crocus she saw was one Uba brought her. Issa wouldn't let her out of the cave. The pussy willows had blown and turned green, and the first buds hinted at verdant foliage on the soggy spring day early in her 11th year when Ayla's labor began. The beginning contractions were easy. Ayla sipped willow bark tea, talking to Issa and Uba, excitedly pleased that the time had finally come. By the next day, she was sure she would be holding her own baby in her arms. Issa had reservations, but tried not to show them. The conversation turned, as it did so often lately with Issa and her two daughters, to medicine. "Mother, what was that root you brought me the day you went out and got so sick?" Ayla motioned. "It's called rattlesnake root. It's not commonly used because it should be chewed when it's fresh, and it must be collected in late fall. It's very good for preventing miscarriage. But how many women threaten to miscarry only in late fall? It loses its effectiveness when it's dried."
"What does it look like?" Uba asked.
Issa's illness had sharpened Uba's interest in the healing herb she would one day dispense, and both Issa and Ayla were training her. But training Uba was different from training Ayla. To gain the full value of her brain, Uba only needed to be reminded of what she knew and see how it was applied. "It's really two plants, a male and a female. It has a long stalk growing out of a cluster of leaves near the ground, and small flowers clinging close to the top, partway down the stalk. The male flowers are white. The root is from the female plant. Its flowers are smaller and green."
"Did you say it grows in pine forests?" Ayla motioned.
"Only damp ones.
It likes moisture, bogs, wet places in meadows, often in upland woods.
You should never have gone out that day, Isa. I was so worried.
Oh, wait, another one is starting.
The medicine woman studied Ayla. She was trying to judge how long the pains were. It would be a long time yet, she decided.
It wasn't raining when I started out, Isa said. I thought it was going to be warm that day.
I was wrong. Fall weather is always unpredictable.
I've been wanting to